Chamber Talk with North Orange County Chamber. My name is Andrew Gregson, and our guest today is Senator Joss Newman. It's great to see you again, Joss, and thank you very much for sharing time with us today.
Glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
And I see that you brought a little bit of an entourage. Can you just share a little bit about yourself?
Hi, everyone. My name is Elizabeth. I'm a district representative in the office of State Senator Joss Newman.
And who's your friend?
My name is Sheen Sidhu, and I am the district representative for the office of Senator Newman.
Excellent. Thank you very much. All right. And then you, sir, who are you?
I'm the guy they brought. I'm Joss Newman. So I have the privilege of representing California's 29th Senate District, which includes all or parts of 16 cities across three counties. So 10 cities in North Orange County, 5 cities in southeastern L.A. County, and the city of Chino Hills in San Bernardino County.
It's a large area that I want to just share a little bit about you, Joss, just before I ask you a few questions. So you grew up on the East Coast, New York State, in the city of, how do you say that?
No, Poughkeepsie. It's a Native American word. It makes something like little house by the watering hole. Or that's what we learned in school.
You attended Yale University. You majored in history and focused on 20th century politics and government. You served as an artillery officer in the United States Army. Thank you for your service. And you relocated to California from Hawaii following the completion of your active service or your military career. After some years, you worked in the private sector and you were first elected in 2016, I believe, and then again in 2020 as the representative, as you just stated, the 29th district, and which comprises of Los Angeles County, Orange County and San Bernardino County. That's a large area there. So first off, growing up, you know, I read that your father was a surgeon and worked in two hospitals in emergency rooms, which that's how it was back then. They didn't have people just in the hospital staff. And your mum was extremely active in the school district and then later became an elected official. Do you somewhat feel that you were influenced by your parents?
I guess we all are, right? So I mean, you either try to be like your parents or try to be not like your parents. So my dad was a small-town doctor. I grew up in a little town. And my mom was a small-town community participant. So when I was, I think, in seventh grade, she ran for school board and was the president of our little school board for a while. So maybe I got some of my kind of impulse for public service from her. She was also the mayor of my little hometown for a couple of years, right after my dad passed away. I'm probably more like my parents than I want to admit.
So we probably all are. You became a commissioned officer in 1986, right?
Correct.
I actually joined a year later in 1987. Not the artillery, though, obviously. And you were stationed in the Republic of Korea while specializing in the nuclear weapons unit. And this was, for me, when I was in the Army at that time, it was the height of the Cold War. Is that the reason why the military, the American military, were in South Korea at that time after the...
Yeah, so you know we're still in South Korea, but and as some of your listeners may know, the South Korean conflict actually has never formally ended. It was paused through an armistice, but there's never been a kind of a formal ending to that war. So U.S. forces have been there for quite a while, and I was there during, as you mentioned, during kind of the height of the Cold War, the Reagan administration. A couple of years prior to my being there, there'd been an incident right on the demilitarized zone where North Korean soldiers had killed an American soldier with an axe. And so there was a real tension there. And the unit that I was in was specialized in nuclear support. And so what we did was we had teams who actually, in kind of our worst case scenario, would have gone and received nuclear munitions and then operationalized them and coordinated with Korean army units to actually fire nuclear artillery munitions downward. Really interesting kind of dicey mission, especially for a 24-year-old kid.
After leaving the military, I know you've had a brief history in politics. I mean, that's quite a strange going from one to the other. How did you lead into that?
So I moved to San Francisco. That's actually where I got out of the Army from Hawaii. My last duty station was in Hawaii. And I had a friend who was working on a political campaign, a mayoral campaign, so kind of stumbled in, and the press secretary asked me if I wanted to help out. And as you mentioned, I was a history major from Yale. I thought it would be cool to work on a big city mayoral campaign. So I started as, you know, like the intern who was going to do the newsletter, and one thing led to another. He turned into a paying job. I became the something called the issues director, you know, researching issues, doing questionnaires. Then I became the deputy press secretary, and then the candidate, his name was Frank Jordan, he wound up winning. So I wound up working for the mayor of San Francisco for a couple of years. And when you say brief history, I think at the time, I will admit that I was probably young and kind of naive, and I was continually shocked that politics wasn't like the books I read in college. So I think I got a little disillusioned with, you know, that brand of politics, and so, you know, wound up going off and doing some other things.
So then once you moved out from that, you went straight into the private sector, and basically, I'm assuming because your mind was working with strategies and things, you went into marketing and software.
No, I actually entered the first thing I did, or the thing I did after that, was I wound up moving to Southern California, kind of on a lark, you know, and wound up working in the entertainment business for, I guess, about 6 years, and worked on in production, worked on a bunch of movies and TV shows, some of which I think your listeners have probably seen. So there was the sequel to the Brady Bunch movie, and I worked on the TV show The Nanny. And my major claim to fame, I don't know if it's in your notes, is I worked on the first Austin Powers. I was on the crew, but one day one of the...
You were in it, right?
I am. I am. So, only because one of the stuntmen one day left because he wouldn't wear a wool uniform. So if you've seen the movie, there's a scene where the Fembots are called out and to demonstrate their powers. They shoot the guards, and so I'm the middle guard out of these five security guards that come in and get seduced and then shot.
So were you in any other movies then, Josh?
Oh, I'm glad you asked. I'm glad I'm here to talk about public service and politics. So yes, I was. I was actually 20 years prior, I was in high school. They made a movie at my school. It's called The World According to Garp. It starred Robin Williams and John Lithgow and Glenn Close. And I am a concerned student, and I have dialogue all of like 11 words with Glenn Close.
So after the movie sort of career, that's sort of, you know, you got to put that down. It's a resume. It's
brief,
a career.
My brief but shiny career. Yeah,
yeah, that's really good. Well, you know, you ended up on a high note, and you left when you should have.
Yeah, I left.
You know, before you failed.
I left
right?
at the top.
You did. Top of your game.
Top of my game.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
So then you went into working for companies doing marketing and business development, right?
Yeah. I actually worked for a series of internet and mobile companies, right? So I was hired in 1999. It was a time where the internet was changing
very
quickly.
Yeah, right in the middle of it, right?
Yeah, yeah. And so there was a company called Real Networks that pioneered streaming, right? So first audio, then video, onto the internet. That was that was new technology at the time. So why not work for a series of companies that did some version of delivering media, first over the internet, then over mobile channels. I worked for another company that did all the text message voting for American Idol for the first couple of years. Mm. And so it worked sales, business development, marketing for a series of technology companies.
You started, was in a foundation called Armed Force 2 Workforce?
Yeah, so foundation's kind of being too generous. So around 2012, my wife and I moved to Orange County relatively near that time. And I got really interested in the question about why young veterans were coming home from their service, you know, from Iraq, Afghanistan, from those two wars, and were having so much trouble finding good work, you know, career-oriented work once they came home. And having been in the military, you know, I've always been very aware of like what great employees veterans make, right, once they transition to civilian life. And so did not make a lot of sense to me that you know, especially for those vets who were coming over that didn't have service-related issues, you know, related to their deployments, you know, why they were challenged, right? Why they often came home and kind of floundered in California's civilian labor market. So I started a little initiative, and the idea was I thought I could kind of build a better mousetrap to match up companies who were looking for good employees, veterans, and vets who had come home that had skills that employers were looking for.
And did you, when you first left the military, did you go through a period yourself of that strange adjustment that there is?
I think I did. I mean, you know, so I think it was different, right? So I did not serve in combat. I got out before the first Gulf War, right? Mm-hmm. So I was in a couple of units that almost went and did stuff, right? So
right.
We almost went to Panama. You know, my unit in Hawaii almost went to Panama. My unit in Hawaii almost went to the Philippines. But I got out, like I said, months before the Gulf War buildup really started in earnest. But, you know, I didn't have any of the kind of intense experience that a lot of soldiers and vets have had since then. But I will say, you know, it was odd, right, coming back to San Francisco in 1990. That's not a place where military services at the time especially was recognized as, you know, sort of useful. The other interesting thing back then is I don't remember anybody thanking me for my service. I mean, it's kind of a common, you know, kind of convention these days. And that grew up, to my kind of knowledge, like after 9/11, right, where people, I think, are truly grateful for the young men and women who've gone out and protected the U.S. during it, kind of a challenging time. But prior to that, you know, that there was not that convention where you met a vet and said, oh, thank you for your service. You know, there's another side to it. And this is why I kind of got interested in trying to solve for that problem, like helping vets kind of move into the next chapter of their lives, is on the one hand, you know, these young people would, you know, constantly, hit, especially in uniform, somebody want to buy your lunch, you buy a drink, whatever, thank you. But as far as somebody saying like, hey, let me show you how to navigate the civilian work landscape, that's a much different thing. And so we, especially in politics, you know, we wound up with this big gap between the rhetoric around, you know, thank you for your service, and you people are awesome, and the programs. And so that, you know, that was kind of the problem I got immersed 2012 on trying to solve.
You mentioned earlier you didn't really see too much active service yet. You sort of did, because you were out there just in case. And what people don't often realize is most or all service personnel, when they do sign up and join the military, it doesn't matter what branch, you are really signing a blank check potentially to lay your life down for others. So it's not whether somebody saw you know, combat or not, at the end of the day, they were all willing and prepared to do exactly the same thing. And I feel, especially just as we're on the eve of Veterans Day here, Remembrance Day in the UK, is that, you know, it's important to think back for those who actually gave their all for our today. It's very, very, very crucial.
I couldn't agree more, especially now. This country's huge, right? A very small share of our population actually serves in the military. They come from typically, you know, different places than lots of other people. So we don't see them too often. So it's, I think it's important to acknowledge their commitment, their sacrifice, their contributions.
And, you know, let's move into your current career now. What inspired you to originally run for the Senate?
So it's funny. It actually relates directly to my experience working on the veterans stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And I focused very squarely on unemployment. There's a lot of very complicated problems that other folks are working on. And actually at that time, a bunch of, you know, people had come together in Orange County to try to align, you know, all the different service providers. And we wound up standing up something called the Orange County Veterans and Military Families Collaborative. And I wound up being in charge of kind of the employment group, and a whole bunch of other folks working on different issues, behavioral health, families, those kinds of things. And collectively, I think, you know, and they have since continued to make a difference. But through that, I wound up meeting a lot of elected people. And it was the elected people who would come to the Veterans Day event, the job fair, you know, those kinds of things. And as I mentioned, they would always say nice things. Mm-hmm. But the gap between rhetoric and actual programs, I thought I had a problem that was not so hard to solve if we just put better programs in place and kind of align services better. And I would always say to whomever I met, like, you know, hey, I think there's a better way to do this. And they'd say, oh, they'd always say, call my office. I'd love to talk to you. You're awesome. And I had stunningly little success, you know, or traction doing that. And it was probably 2015. I'd had sort of one of these kind of typical experiences. And I remember my wife and I were having dinner, and I was probably grousing about it, you know, the way people do, the way I do.
I do every night.
And she said to me, and she remembers saying it, she'll admit she said it, she said to me in that way that people do, she said, you know, if you really want to change things, right, in that voice, right, which is to say, like, you know, I'm tired of listening to you. She said, our state senator's termed out, so if you really want to change things, you know, maybe you should think about running yourself, like that. And like I said, she didn't really mean it, and she has regretted it 1,000 times since. But that's, I don't even know how she knew that. I didn't know that, you know, that it was Bob Huff, decent guy, but he was termed out. I don't think I was that aware of that. And said, so that's what gave me kind of the germ of the idea.
Wow.
And the observation really was, you know, like, why not? Right. I thought I had something to offer, but it was like, wow, if we won't solve the problem that everybody agrees on.
Right.
Everybody agrees that, you know, vets deserve more. Mm-hmm. If we're not, both sides, irrespective of politics, I mean, right. agree on that. If we're not willing to do things to make that better, like what are the odds we're going to solve harder problems
right.
politically, right?
Yeah.
You know, where there are competing ideologies, you know, different stakeholders, that kind of thing. So that's kind of what got me thinking about it. And so I decided to throw my hat in the ring and wound up running in 2016.
And I do know that you've actually implemented, well, quite a few bills. However, one of them was to do with the veterans thing. Because, I mean, actions speak louder than mm-hmm. words. And mm-hmm. you got one passed, didn't you? You want to share
yeah, it? Yeah, I think I've done a bunch of good work. So two bills. The one that's probably worth mentioning here was, you know, there was a real problem at that time, but there still is to an extent, of vets coming home who go to school,
right?
You know, coming out of their service, decide to pursue an educational goal. And there's, you know, there's 116 community colleges in California, and there really was no standard, no baseline level of service. So a vet coming home could go to a community college that might have a wonderful veterans resource center and sort of associated programs. Or they might go to another one where they had effectively nothing. And that seemed really unfair to me. It shouldn't be kind of Russian roulette, you know, what sort of support you get when you come home. So I had a bill that actually got incorporated into the 2017 budget that, you know, created, additional funding and standards for veteran resource centers and community colleges.
And when you create something like that, and this is, I really honestly don't know the answer to this, how do you make sure that it gets follow through? Like, you know, you get the budget, you do the work, like you say, right?
Yeah.
What makes it
that
get to the next
is
stage?
That's one of the big challenges in a state as large and complex as California, right? So, I mean, sure, we'll get deeper into legislation, et cetera, but as an elected official, as a state legislator, you really have three responsibilities, right? There's three parts of your job. One is legislation. The second is constituent service, right? That's what my folks down here mostly focus on, make sure that our constituents get good service, or they have problems with unemployment, those kinds of things. And then the third is oversight, right? And that's where we make sure that when we give money to a department or change a program or implement a law, that hopefully where the legislature makes sure that the things we set out to do, we're doing as well as we can. And so I stayed active, you know, sort of monitoring those programs, but it is a challenge. And the allocation was $5 million of additional funding per year. That doesn't go that far in a state mm-hmm. this big, and hopefully it's spread out equitably. But I have a pretty good relationship with the community college system. I serve on the Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs. So, you know, that's kind of where we would exercise that oversight function.
If you were to sort of sum it up, what does the state senator's office actually do for the community?
We are the people that, you know, the voters or residents of our community have hired to represent us in Sacramento. And state government does a lot of things in California, right? So state government pays for the schools. There's a whole bunch of structures that actually administer these things. State government creates the laws that tell you how much you're going to be taxed. State government has a huge impact on health care. State government has a big impact on public safety. There's virtually no sphere in anybody's life where the state government and the people who make the laws, you know, that actually shape state government don't have an impact on your lives. And it is interesting. Like, it's election season now. I'm not sure when this podcast is going to run, but we're the Monday before election day.
Probably tonight, as you want people to go out and vote by tomorrow.
Right. So tonight, okay. Well, so you know, we follow national. Well, some of us follow national politics, and you know, it's kind of interesting soap opera like drama.
Right.
And you know, it's important, but quite often people don't give the same amount of attention to state government, local government, county government. And it's ironic because, you know, those other three areas actually probably have a bigger impact day to day on the quality of people's lives and the resources that are available to them and the laws that affect them. And so, you know, one of my kind of emphases is really about civic engagement, civic knowledge, and trying to figure out ways, both legislatively and otherwise, like how we can better engage people. Sorry about that. So that they're more aware, but more importantly, more engaged in these processes, right? So that their voice is heard, but also they understand why we do what we do. And then when it comes to elections, you know, I'm glad if they make a vote that doesn't have to be for me, but it should be in the service of making things better.
Thank you for that reminder, Josh. So those of you who hear this between now and tomorrow, November the 8th, just remember, it's very important to go out and vote. Your vote counts. Something we don't see, like, could you share? I mean, it's got to be difficult through election season when you're actually a candidate. What are some of the sort of challenges that you face on that, apart from being exhausted, talking everywhere?
Yeah, and so, you know, elections, you know, especially like tomorrow's election day, right? Mm-hmm. And you read about it, and there's the horse race and the drama and, you know, the national kind of trends and dynamics. But if you really drill down, I mean, elections are how we as voters hire the people, right? Mm-hmm. That voting is how we hire the people who work for us in the public sphere. There's no other way to do it, right? So we collectively make a decision by voting, which one of the candidates gets to actually serve for, you know, in whatever office for some time. So being a candidate is kind of a fascinating thing, because I've got lots of jobs, but never had to do it that way. And what you're doing, in effect, when you go out and campaign is you're asking for the job. And then there's a whole bunch of other layers and kind of dynamics to it that because of the way politics works these days, that, you know, tons of money, especially at the state level and above, but also kind of a meanness, right? I mean, you know, if politics is a kind of marketing, some of that marketing is like about as mean and
as it can get.
It can possibly get. And so for my part, you know, starting in 2016, I mean, I'll admit, like, I didn't know better. My wife kind of goaded me to it, as I've said, but, you know, I thought, like, you know, I've got, you know, I'm a naive guy, but I've got something to offer. Let me put my hat in the ring and make my case. And it was going great for a little while until the stakes got high. And then I really wasn't prepared, I guess, for two things. One was, you know, everybody's from a party typically. It's very hard for, you know, somebody who's an independent to get elected in California, especially at the state level. So I'm a Democrat, but I'm a centrist kind of pragmatic guy. I really wasn't prepared. I had to go in and meet people. Mm-hmm. And have them hate me because they'd heard I was on the other team,
it were.
Mm. And, you know, nothing in my life prior to that had prepared me, right? In the military, everybody loves you, right? In business, if somebody doesn't know you, they're happy to meet you and find out kind of what are you selling? How can we work together? In politics, you know, you go in a room, you don't know the 30 people in there, but 20 of them know they don't like you, right?
Yeah.
Because of, you know, the color of your jersey, I mean, if you think it's right, which is really strange, right? And some of it's probably reasonable, all things considered. But if you're the person doing it, it's really disorienting. The other thing that's I really wasn't prepared for, I don't think anybody is when you get into the kind of the meat of a campaign and the other side and their allies start sending the mail to your constituents, including your house. That tells everybody what a jerk you are, what a terrible person you are, with the terrible things you've done in your life that show that you're unfit for service. And not only was I not ready for that, but my wife was, I think, absolutely thrown for a loop by it. I remember one day she came up from the mailbox. We live on a hill, and she kind of had her hand behind her back. And I was like, hey, what's in the mail? And she said, oh, you don't even want to know, right? And so to have... groups that you don't really know spend literally millions of dollars communicating to voters what a, you know, sort of satanic creature you are is really, really nuts. And it does sting, right? And I also think it dissuades a lot of people from getting involved.
What happens on that handover period? Because obviously you've been working for a long period of time. You've got topics that you're trying to figure out and things like that. What goes on when they do a handover?
So I guess in my case, I mean, I'm not sure, you know, what should happen, there's a bunch of files and information, especially relating to constituent casework, right? So, you know, somebody's got a problem with their unemployment insurance in November, right? You would hope that come December, when the next person takes over, that person doesn't have to start over. But, you know, most of it's informal. There's no formal requirement. I remember Senator Huff's office was in Brea. We took over that office. I now have a different office in Fullerton. But I sort of vaguely remember somebody gave me a key, right, and gave my staff keys. And they went in, they looked in the file cabinets to see what was in there. And I think, you know, a couple folks talked to a couple of folks who left, but there wasn't a ton of interaction.
It's just like in business, right? There's no difference, really. Yeah. It's just the same stuff. So you mentioned, obviously, your wife, Darcy. You live here with your lovely little daughter. And you actually live here in Fullerton,
I think I live a half mile from where we're sitting.
When did you first come to Fullerton? Why Fullerton?
Early 2012. My wife, as you mentioned, I'm from the East Coast originally. I've lived a bunch of places. My wife is from Orange County. She was actually born across the street, St. Jude's, and grew up in first Orange, then Anaheim Hills, and works for an Orange County company, big insurance company. And we were living up in L.A., and it made sense. She had a long commute, but at the same time, her mom had been diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's, and it was progressing rapidly, right? So it made sense to us to kind of look at moving a little closer to her, where she was from. Mm-hmm. And we, found a realtor, found a house right by Laguna Lake in Fullerton.
Right.
And, moved here. And for my part, I'd always lived in big cities, right? I lived in L.A., Seattle, San Francisco, Honolulu. So moving to kind of this part of Orange County was an interesting shift. I'm sure no different than you coming from New Jersey or wherever your accent indicates you're from. I love it. Fullerton reminds me a lot of my hometown where I grew up, kind of small. Mine was a little smaller, but small enough that, kind of who's who, and mm-hmm. it's got this nice vibe. And Fullerton has this wonderful downtown, and, Cal State Fullerton's near here. So couldn't be happier living here.
Living in Fullerton, do you feel compelled sometimes being in politics to stretch that threshold and knock on city council's door and say, hey, what's going on, folks? Or, I don't like this. Or, how do you keep that line of divide?
So, I have a particular job at, in a particular level of government. So I'd like to think I'm their partner, right? As opposed to, I'm not better than anybody. Right.
Right.
So I live in Fullerton, but I represent currently, 16 different cities.
Sure.
And so my job, my office's job, is to be a good advocate for those cities and a good resource for those cities and all the various groups within them. And so I'd like to think we've been pretty good partners over the years. So Fullerton and a whole bunch of other cities are now part of an 11-city collaborative working, getting on the root cause of homelessness and youth violence prevention, post-incarceration stuff. So that's a good example, I think, of partnering with cities. I wouldn't presume to tell a city council person how to do their business.
As a resident, though, you see, that's the difference, isn't it? Because
I don't do it as like the senator guy, right?
No,
but
that's
I'll
what
call
I mean,
up and say, hey, there's graffiti in my neighborhood.
Right, right,
I just
right.
noticed today there's a storm drain that's collapsed over around the corner. But I go on the DPW, the Public Works website, and
put
my request and stuff.
Okay, that's cool.
Yeah. But again, to be clear, my job is to represent this city. The city council members' job is to represent now they have their districts and the city as a whole. Glad to part. But I've never sort of played the senator card.
Yeah, right? Yeah. No,
so
I get you.
As an example, I was working on we had a construction project at my house. Found myself sitting at the city hall in the planning department waiting for my permit to get reviewed. For a way long time, but right. I, for me, it's probably good and illuminating because that's what everybody else goes through.
Yeah.
I don't need special.
You get to experience it. That's true. That's true. One interesting fact when you were talking about campaigning and things is you have an ice cream truck. I've noticed at the events. What? That's a brilliant idea. But what inspired you to do that?
That's nice of you to say. So I, as you probably gathered a little bit, as a aspiring public servant, you learn pretty quickly that politics it should not be an end in and of itself, right? And politics today is kind of complicated and in many ways unpleasant. But one of the defining characteristics is how estranged people, how removed people are from politics, how rare they actually know the people who represent them, especially if you go up kind of a couple levels, county, state. Mm-hmm. One of the riddles you're always trying to solve as you're running is how do you actually engage people so that A, they know who you are and that I think they're favorably inclined to vote for you, but B, you want to start that conversation so that you can get from them in the same way that you would give to them your priorities. I want to know what their priorities are, what their needs are, what their pain points are. Mm-hmm. So I've tried a bunch of different stratagems over the years that some of you're fairly creative, some have worked better than others. So had a kid in a bear costume during 2016. This myth mm-hmm. kind of grew up that it was me. That's not true. Had this remote control blimp that we thought was genius, right? Because it's a Newman for Senate. Turns out it only works if people are looking up. And then, you know, in this most recent cycle, was thinking about, like, you know, how can I go out, kind of engage people? And I'm not sure how I thought of the idea, but I thought, you know, what if I had an ice cream truck? And then as I mulled it over, I had this idea that the URL, you know, the website, mm-hmm. bettersenator.com was right. available. So we call it Better Senator Ice Cream.
Just out of interest, do you have ice cream for people who are lactose intolerant?
So we have, it's branded ice cream sandwich, but we have popsicles.
That's good, you see.
And the weirdest thing is popsicles often cost more than ice cream sandwiches.
Oh, but they do.
Which I found a little puzzling.
Yeah.
But I guess we'll have to find a better distributor for our popsicle.
They have it though. So, you know, regardless, you can always come up to Senator Newman's ice cream truck and mm-hmm.
But you will see it clearly indicates ice cream sandwich. But if you ask, right, there are, you know, non-lactose products.
That's awesome.
Singular.
Beautiful. Right. That's good. I love it. That's excellent. Mm-hmm. But I think it's a great idea, and you're totally right. It's great to be out there in and amongst things. And when we actually do chamber events, and whether, you know, I know you're a very busy individual, but you often, just like other politicians, we have these wonderful representatives who come out there as well. And it means a lot to people. It really does. When people see that they're out there and they're talking to them and they're heard, it is important. So we appreciate that.
I think so. And I think my staff has to listen to me. But I have a wonderful team of people that work for me here at the district level, you know, to cover different cities. And those are the folks you see. So Elizabeth and Sheen are here today. But we have others. And then up in Sacramento, I have a bunch of really smart young people thinking about policy stuff and legislative work that we do. But I think it's really important that people, like I said, are connected to the people who serve them. And then as we do our work, that we're, appropriately sort of respectful and honor the things that we do in the community. And so the work that, for instance, Chambers of Commerce do, very important. But the opportunity to recognize people for achieving all manner of things is, I think it's important. It's a privilege for me to be able to do this.
I feel the same way. And whilst we're on that point, I do want to give a shout out to one of your employees, Scott Dew. He comes to nearly all our events, and he does a great job. So thank you, Scott. Appreciate it.
Nice to hear. Until now, I kind of wondered what Scott did all day.
He does a lot. He does a lot. He stands there. He smiles well. He hands over the certificates mm-hmm. really well, mm-hmm. and he really engages with people.
Okay, but he also loves the work, right? And I think your members feel that, right? And that's true of every single person on my team.
Oh yeah.
And so that's important. And if they don't, call me. Right, we'll take it up.
Text you now. Yeah. I've got your cell. Yeah. I'm good. Okay. Joss, I also read you were a court-appointed special advocate. Would you mind sharing a little bit about that?
Probably 2014 or so. I can't remember exactly when, but my wife and I, she brought me to an informational session. There's a program, it's called CASA, Court-Appointed Special Advocate. And what CASA does is you are both a mentor and an advocate to a child in the foster system. Mm-hmm. California has upwards of 60,000 young people in the foster system. Orange County is one of the largest counties in the state, has our fair share. And many of that's a kid who, for lots of reasons, has been remanded to state custody or placed in a foster home because of challenges within their home or something that's happened to their parents or, you know, with their parents. And that system is really overwhelming, right, for a young person who's, you know, especially when they're really young. Mm. And so what the CASA program does is it matches up adults with a child, right, who is in that, you know, very, very precarious situation, hopefully for not forever, and acts as their voice, right, when it comes to representing them through all of the myriad steps, right, including court hearings, work with social workers, dealing with their schooling. So I and my wife both, I was matched up to a young man mm-hmm. Who had been taken from his parents because of domestic abuse and was working toward reunification, right? His mom was taking classes and parenting, and eventually he was reunited with his mom. And then my wife had a young woman who, same thing, and so really interesting because there is, for a lot of us who, you know, are reasonably privileged, right, and live in Orange County. Orange County is this, you know, on its surface, like this amazingly privileged place.
Right.
You know, but there's a whole other, you know, sort of sector in our community that's really challenged. And so it was interesting and I think really illuminating for me, especially in the work I'm doing right now, to have to be in that world, to sort of see the world through their eyes, to sit for a full day in juvenile court, right, down in Orange, is to give you insight on a part of Orange County that many of us don't see but probably don't want to think about.
Right.
But where there's a real need for service, for resources, for new programs to solve a lot of problems.
Well, that's really good to hear, and I'm glad there is a system like that.
I will say, just as a plug, so it's called CASA, the CASA Orange County. And if you're interested and you have the time, you are doing a wonderful service for a young person who often has nobody in their life who is actually, you know, actively looking out for them.
Right. So, you know, as we're coming toward the end of our podcast today, you know, and again, thank you very much for coming and taking time out today. Really do appreciate it. What's in the future for Senator Joss Newman?
So every politician, every elected person is different. I don't have a plan per se, right? So I do have a plan to run for re-election at the moment. That's my plan in 2024. In California, we have term limits. You get 12 years total. But beyond that, I wouldn't presume to, you know, make a plan beyond that. This is, to me, I've done, you know, as we've discussed, a bunch of things. And serving in the legislature is the same kind of sort of privilege as I found serving in the U.S. military, to be part of something which is bigger than oneself, where you're actually, in this case, being part of conversations that actually shape California's budget, California's future. So it's an awesome kind of gratifying privilege to do. I'd like to do this for as long as I can. I don't have a plan beyond that.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, what I would like to see if you could plan for is maybe attend our big giveaway business mixer that we're having down at the Boys and Girls Club in Fullerton. It's on November the 21st. It starts at 11:30, and we've got quite a few businesses, one in particular, Sarian's Arthur, who's giving away some of their branding clothing to the Boys and Girls Club. And we'd love for you to be able to be at that. We'll give you a free sandwich for sure. And if you can't, please maybe scuttle me there.
I will try to attend even if you don't give me a free sandwich.
Oh, that's really nice.
Yeah,
that'd be lovely. Josh, thank you so very much for coming in today. We really appreciate your time. It's been a total honor and a blast. For those of you listening, as the Senator had mentioned earlier, it is vital that you cast your vote because every vote counts. And remember, you have until tomorrow, November 8th, to cast your vote. And we invite you to join our email list by visiting nocchamber.com and selecting sign up for news at the top of the page. For more interviews, visit chambertalk.podbean.com.